Greetings from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. As we record this podcast, I recognize and acknowledge that I'm located on the traditional territories of the Mississauga and Haudenosaunee nations and within the lands protected by the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Agreement. I am Selina Mudavanu.
Greetings from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta. The city of Calgary is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta, Districts 5 and 6. I am Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare.
Welcome to the Black Professors Podcast.
Selina and I are faculty members who are trained in media and communication studies.
And we worked in radio and television broadcasting at some point in our careers.
Our interests include digital storytelling, radio, and alternative media forms. On the podcast, Black professors will be asked about their pathways into academia and how they found themselves in their areas of specializations. They will also be asked to talk about the political, social, and other contexts that impacted their decisions to enter academia.
They'll be asked to share stories about their research and teaching trajectories, high and low lights in their careers, awards and grants they won, courses they developed, as well as their current research and teaching interests.
These professors will be invited to give advice to young people in Black communities and to their early career colleagues on successfully navigating the academy.
The professors will also be requested to speak about their favorite foods, hobbies, holiday destinations, as well as how they endeavor to maintain the work-life balance. Welcome to another episode of the Black Professors Podcast. Today, we are joined by Professor Fred Ofosu. Professor Ofosu is Professor Emeritus at McMaster University. He holds a Doctor of Philosophy degree. His research interests are in hematology, blood transplants, marrow transplants, pathology, molecular medicine, coagulation, platelets, blood coagulation, blood transfusion, blood disorders, clinical hematology. He is one of the co-founders of the African Caribbean Faculty Association of McMaster, popularly known as ACFAM. Professor Ofosu, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much, Professor Fosu. And you've agreed that we go on with Fred. So Fred, it's so exciting to have you here. And what a profile. Very, very exciting profile. I will start with my first question. Had you always wanted to be a professor?
Interesting question. No, when I was younger, I wanted to be a lawyer because the people in my family that I looked up to at that time were justices. These are three great uncles who eventually became Supreme Court justices in Ghana. So you can see my interest. I wanted to join the law profession. But that was not to be, because in high school, my principal refused to allow me to study in the arts. He said, this country doesn't need any more lawyers, but it needs scientists. So this is how I directed into the sciences in high school, which I pursued subsequently. But the path that I took in sciences will surprise you. I went to the library in my high school and read an article in Scientific American written by a fellow called Albert Sangiorgi. He was a biochemist, and he described the respiration system, the molecular understanding of the respiration, and that blew my mind. So I decided, in fact, I wanted to become like him, a biochemist. So that's what led me on this route. But I had no intention when I was in high school of becoming a scientist. That was a path, only path open to me by my principal. This was in Ghana, mind you, in the 1950s.
Oh, that is quite interesting. And speaking about Ghana, which high schools did you go to?
Okay, well, the high school I went to was in a town called Cape Coast, a historical town called Cape Coast. And the school was at the Saddle College. It was an Anglican high school started in 1910. And being a dyed-in-the-wool Anglican, that was the school, only high school I wanted to go to.
Excellent. That's so fascinating and exciting, Fred. And we have that principal to thank for all the amazing work that you have done over the years.
I once visited the Cape Coast castles in Ghana. How was it like growing up in the Cape Coast with castles that had this horrendous history of trading human beings as slaves? How was that like?
Well, the first time I went to see the castle, this was my second year in high school in Cape Coast. I could not believe it that men could be so cruel to other men, especially people who call themselves Christians. It flew me. I just could not understand it. How could Christians behave the way they did? But there was nobody that I could ask who could answer that question for me. And I think I figured it out myself when I was much older. And the motivation was nothing other than greed. The slavery business, as far as I'm concerned, was nothing other than greed. That people were in a position to enslave others. And there were two sides to this enslavement, the people who were doing the selling or capturing the people, and the people who bought it, because all of them claimed they were Christians. And it's difficult to understand how anybody who considers himself a Christian will purchase another human being.
Thank you very much, Fred. Very deeply moving subject. How did this impact your later life?
Well, I was very fortunate as a child growing up. I had a most influential grandmother, maternal grandmother, who taught me to forgive all things that people do. Because if you don't, and you get yourself wrapped up in it, you may not get yourself out of it. And don't be a judge of people's behavior. Because in the end, there's somebody who will judge all of us called God. Knowing that I don't have to worry about what anybody did, because all of us have a judge.
Thank you, Fred. Those are words on marble, Selena.
So here you are. You have done your PhD. What next? Where did you go with the PhD?
It was very simple because I came to Canada in 1963 to obtain my doctorate in biochemistry so that I could return to Ghana to teach at the medical school. That is where I saw my future, plain and simple. So I knew where I was going. There was no doubt about it. So the day that I defended my thesis, which was on July 31st, 1971, I was on a flight to Ghana. I was that dedicated to go and work at the Ghana Medical School. I was there for 2 years and gave it up. I recognized that I will probably be wasting my talent because all I will be doing is teaching people something that I did not do myself, teaching from somebody's textbook. And I was never going to be in a position to do any meaningful research. So I packed up and came back to Canada to try to get into the research stream.
Thank you so much for sharing. It's this question about members of the diaspora, this thing that's always there. Should you go back? Should you come? Where is home? Where would you therefore consider home? Would you say Ghana is more home or Canada?
Canada is home. I've lived here for 61 years, so I know this country a lot more than I know Ghana. Even though my roots in Ghana go a long way, I can trace my root for six generations.
You wanted to become a biochemist, like that
Yes.
author you had read. So what informed your decision then to specialize in your field in hematology and other related areas?
Well, when I went to University of Toronto to do my doctorate from McMaster after my bachelor's at McMaster, I ran into an amazing individual. He was the head of the department who had recruited me from McMaster because he came to give a lecture at McMaster, and the head of the department at the time brought him to the lab course that I was doing. I was selling, doing experiments, etc. And he introduces himself as the head of the Department of Biochemistry and said, "The head of your department has told me you're interested in studying about blood." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, as long as you have the grade, when you graduate, you have a space in my lab." That was the only interview I had with this person. And he took me on as soon as I got my bachelor's degree. So it was quite a break from somebody I had never met before.
Do you mind talking us through what it was like coming to Canada? This is a different climate, different country, different culture, very different from Ghana. How was that like?
Well, it was a difficult decision on one hand, but I thought if I was to be able to teach at a medical school, I need to have university education and also postgraduate education. So it was fairly easy. Now, I had never heard of Canada as a place to study in high school because, as I said, I had three great uncles who became Supreme Court justices and they studied in the UK. So that was my orientation. I applied to go to Oxford and Cambridge to study biochemistry. The answer I got from both was the same. To study biochemistry at the universities, in your last 2 years of high school, you had to have studied and did well in physics, mathematics, and chemistry. And in my case, I studied physics, chemistry, and biology. The biology wasn't required. I needed to have mathematics. I was not interested in staying another year in high school to get my A-level certificate in math. So I came to Canada instead.
Excellent choice. And that's why we have the wonderful benefit of chatting with you today, Fred. So when you moved to Canada, what work did you do?
My family and I returned to Toronto and did a 2 year stint as a postdoc. The area was cystic fibrosis. It's an illness that makes it extremely difficult for people to get rid of phlegm that accumulates in their lungs. So I spent 2 years as a postdoctoral fellow in that. Towards the end of that second year, there was a position available at McMaster University and also the Canadian Blood Services. So the two organizations hired me as a scientist by the Blood Services and a lecturer by the Department of Pathology. So I worked for both organizations. And I found it exciting for one reason. The Transfusion Blood Services wanted me to bring in some research into the organization. The research that I undertook with the help of the medical director at the Blood Services was hemophilia, from Greek meaning a person who loves blood. It's a bleeding condition because you inherited an abnormal clotting factor gene. So your blood clotted too slowly. And hemophilia, it doesn't give you a lot of pain, but it was hard to stop your bleeding if you started bleeding for any reason, like knocking your knee against a table, something that you bleed into a joint. It was quite a dangerous illness. And at that time in 1973, the only way one of the hemophilias, A, could be treated was to isolate locally from blood a protein called factor VIII. And somebody had discovered about 3 years before that what you have to do to concentrate factor VIII in blood was to freeze the blood and then thaw it slowly in the fridge. And the factor VIII will come out as a precipitate, something that doesn't go back to the solution. So if you centrifuge simply meaning it's like spinning the blood in a device that allows you to get out the solid bit separated from the liquid bit. So after the liquid was drained out, what was left in the blood bag was called cryoprecipitate. Cryo meaning frozen. so that after you remove the free blood, you could then add a little bit of water, maybe about 10 milliliters of water, of salt water, so it's, sterilized water, to dissolve it. And that could be the new product called Factor VIII concentrate. In other words, it was richer in Factor VIII than it would be in the blood. You then inject it into the hemophilia patient, and he'll be good for about 3 to 4 days. If he had four of these cryopreservatives, he'll be good 3 to 4 days without any bleeding. But it meant every 3 to 4 days, he has to go to the hospital to get another infusion. So the challenge, as I saw it, was there must be some other ways of getting this in so that they could take it home and inject themselves. Eventually, that's what came to be. But the field advanced. I was very much involved in it, making this cryoprecipitate in Hamilton for the hemophiliacs in Hamilton. The field advanced to the extent that companies called plasma fractionation companies came up with ways of making the cryoprecipitate in larger quantities so that they can make large batches to be given to thousands of hemophiliacs. So what we had to do as a transfusion service was to get blood from normal donors, remove the red cells and platelets. Red cells are the red part of the blood, and platelets is what allow the blood to clot appropriately. We removed those things away. As a matter of fact, we removed the cells, froze the plasma, and shipped them frozen to the fractionation company. And they returned to us Factor VIII concentrate. In fact, plasma had been concentrated in Factor VIII. Now, they didn't throw the rest of the plasma away. They made things like albumin that some people required as a transfusion after severe injuries, and they bled a lot and they had to replace the volume of blood. They also made something called immunoglobulin, a fancy way of calling antibodies. The portion of the blood that is used to neutralize viruses and bacteria, etc. And some people, unfortunately, inherit a situation where they do not make certain types of antibodies or immunoglobulins. So we will have clotting factor concentrate, we will have albumin, and we will have immunoglobulins. So each unit of blood can be made into at least three different products to be given to three different people. So that the transfusion blood services will send the plasma, frozen plasma, to the USA, and then we'll get back the fractionated product to be used clinically. So that was the area that I put my energies in. We also have to come up with ways of identifying people who had inherited clotting abnormalities, specifically factor VIII, hemophilia A, and factor IX, hemophilia B. If somebody was bleeding, a child, you need to identify whether he had hemophilia A or hemophilia B. We did that by then back up. These individuals, their blood clotted slowly, just at about up to a tenth the speed of normal clotting. So even though they were sick, these people were providing us with plasma that will allow us to assess whether a person who was bleeding had Factor VIII or Factor IX deficiency. Because if you have Factor IX deficient blood, it will take a long time to clot. The only way you correct it is if you add a plasma containing Factor IX. And the other case was true. If he was Factor VIII deficient, the only way you can correct it is to have Factor VIII in the plasma you're testing. So if you did not improve the clotting, it then told you the person didn't have Factor VIII or Factor IX, as the case might be. Now, I came up with the interesting idea of, given my background training, I can come up with a way of making normal blood factor VIII or factor IX deficient. So we have the substrate to test patients' blood for factor VIII or factor IX deficiency. In fact, my work was the first anywhere in the world that did this, so that plasma to test for these abnormalities were a lot easier to obtain. We didn't have to go to a patient to take his blood to do this sort of thing. And I was certainly happy to make the technology available. We published it so other people could do it. And not only that, because I was working for the blood service, I had access to plasma that I can make deficient in factor 8 or factor 9 artificially to be used everywhere at a minimal cost compared to getting it from a patient. And I had also went on to use this technology to the 13 blood clotting factors, actually 11. I use a similar technology to remove any clotting factor I want that we wanted to be removed from blood to allow clinicians to be able to determine which clotting factor was missing. Okay, so this is something that my laboratory developed at McMaster and made available everywhere.
That is fantastic work that you did, and the fact that your research had immediate application to help
Yes.
patients' lives, that is phenomenal. Thank you so much for doing all that work.
Anybody who wanted to use our methods could do it, but also people, if people ask us for these deficient plasma, we are prepared to supply it to them, just they pay for the shipping. But we went further and make all the clotting factor deficient plasmas. Okay, this time we didn't publish them, but companies that were providing clotting factor deficient plasma could buy it from us, and then they could sell it to other people. So it was cheap enough and nobody was put at risk, etc. So it became universally available. I didn't go into the other aspects of research that I used to do, but needed to say, since I was looking at the hemophilia side, hemophilia has the opposite side where people clot too fast in heart attacks, strokes, and clots in the lungs. So when I came to McMaster, people were studying these illnesses, but by interacting with them, I could help them see the problems a little more easily. And among other things, I worked with a group of physicians who became quite good in understanding how something called heparin works. McMaster is famous for that, but a fair bit of that work was done in my laboratory. And I had students and physicians come from all over the world to work in my lab to acquire that skill.
Thank you so much, Fred, for sharing with us today your groundbreaking research and research that had great impact, I must
It had
say.
an impact right
Oh,
away once it was done.
that is wonderful. Thank you for sharing, Fred.
Don't ask difficult questions. It might take you a lifetime to find an answer. Ask simple questions, which, if you find the answer, you will know you have found it. So, if I wanted to remove factor 8, for instance, from normal plasma, how do I do it? And the answer was fairly simple. You have to make in a sheep or something like that antibodies against human factor 8. You do that by isolating human factor 8, and it's not as easy as it is because factor 8 doesn't live by itself in the blood. It travels to something called von Willebrand factor. So if you made an antibody to the factor 8 von Willebrand factor complex and make sure that was all that the antibody was directed against, then we could attach this antibody to a special material so that it has the antibody to factor 8 von Willebrand factor attached to it. Now, if you put that system, a solid system, in a column, you could filter blood through it, and the system, your immunodepleting system will remove the factor 8 von Willebrand complex. So the plasma that flows through will look like a regular plasma, except it takes a long time to clot. And all that you need to correct the clotting defect is to add plasma containing factor 8. So it will do the job. And also, if you give your factor 8 containing cryoprecipitate to a patient, you could take a small sample of the patient's blood, isolate the plasma, and see whether the factor 8 was in the patient's plasma. Yeah. So we had a test, a way to remove what it is or was lacking, and then a way to test whether or not it's a useful product that you've made to test for factor 8 in a patient who had received factor 8. So it was fairly straightforward. Not a difficult question to ask, not a difficult answer when you get it. That was my attitude to research.
Thank you so much for that tip. I'm thinking about teaching and research at the same time. We usually work with students, and what tips would you give in relation to managing, teams of students that you're working with on research? What tips would you have?
Well, I had a tendency to ask them, try to answer a simple question when they were in the lab for the year. Oh, that if you were fortunate, they did find the answer and they will have an excellent grade for that summer. Or sometimes they will do it throughout the year as a project, as a research project and undergraduate research project. So that was my attitude to making sure a student is assigned enough a simple enough a question where in about a year they will be able to get the answer. And I worked at McMaster for 35 years. And over those 35 years, I had about 50 students work in my lab, usually no more than two a year, to do their project for the research project or as a summer job. And some people will start as a summer job and they enjoyed it so much, they will want to come back and work. And I am happy to tell you, by my count, eight of them ended up in medical schools or dental schools.
That is phenomenal. Well done.
For early career faculty, whether it's teaching track or tenure track, what advice would you give to them?
Well, basically, the young person needs to decide why they are there in the first place. Is this the place they want to be? If it is, what have they gone there to do? And frankly, you also need to recognize that, like anything in this world, you cannot do anything by yourself. When a child is born, there are quite a lot of people around the birth situation. Why is that the case? So that he or she can be helped to the extent necessary. When you are an adult, you need to recognize that you cannot solve the world's problems by yourself. You need help at all times and in all places. So surround yourself with people, one, that you can help. That is what motivates those you're helping to contribute to your success. Selfishness never got anybody anywhere in the long term. You need to be a member of the community. Now, some people may want to have anything to do with you. That's all right. That's why I say you need to identify the people that you can assist in your work, on your journey. If you can do that, chances are some of them are going to reciprocate, or at least some of your colleagues are going to find you as a helpful person so that they might contribute to your success. And remember, very few people win the Nobel Prize, especially Black people. I can tell you stories of Black people who could or should have won the Nobel Prize but didn't because their work was stolen by their supervisors. But that is also true for white people. Their work too was stolen by their supervisors. That's how it goes. Some people have no humility. They will steal anything and call it their own. So, yeah, that's how it goes. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there in academia. It's not a very gentle, honest place, etc. There's all kinds of crooked stuff that take place in academia. But frankly, that is not your problem. Your problem is to carve your path by getting people to travel with because you have similar or overlapping interests where helping each other allows you to go a little bit further. I'm told I have what? Something like about close to 300 publications. There are very few that it was just me by myself. I've worked with a lot of people. Sometimes I approach them, sometimes they approach me because I have techniques that might help them advance. And don't be afraid to share it. You can't take it with you. So it's better to share it here I started some good gets done with it. Help whenever you can. As somebody said, what did that guy say now? Remember to do good to all people, especially those of the household of faith. There've been a lot of many wise people who lived long before us, and we need to learn from them and go forward and lead our life. It makes it a lot easier if you don't have to find a path you're treading. Because the paths are there all over, but you need to find something that you can walk on and walk on successfully, and find people who will walk with you and not work against you, walk against you and blocking your path as you go. I mean, path of least resistance, that is my attitude. If I cannot work with you because that is what you want, because you're a lot smarter than me, I'm quite happy to accept that. I brought nothing into this world, and I will take nothing for this. I'm not afraid, for to be rejected.
Amazing. Now at McMaster, there are so many black faculty compared to when you and your colleagues started. What advice would you give about doing those little things that maybe might not have immediate results? What kind of advice would you give around that?
When it comes to university-wide things, we need the help of the leadership of the university. They need to buy into it for it to happen. This is where perhaps we have been successful. So the only time what it is that the African Caribbean Faculty Association has done can continue is to make sure that the future presidents and future provosts, etc., and different department heads continue to buy into it. So that is a task that they really have to do. Because unless a president buys into this sort of thing, nothing will happen. This is precisely what happened before we got together as a faculty association so that we can present a well-thought-out plan to the university president and provost and so on and so forth. University presidents generally last about 10 years. And if we are not careful, the next set of leadership might have no sympathy in getting this sort of thing going. So that is a task that we have to make sure it stays. The Faculty Association has done some amazing things. Imagine Royal Bank of Canada giving $1.5 million to the Black Student Success Center. Those are the type of things that we need to be focused on in ways that we can get even companies, profit-making companies, to buy in so that you can leverage the skills of the people who are in it, getting these things going. You always need money to get things done. So that is a key thing. And getting money is not easy. It's not as difficult sometimes as you make it. Because when I was a faculty member at McMaster, yes, I did bring in quite a lot of grants from granting agencies. But at that time, it was fairly straightforward because of the work that we have published. It was to be approached by companies to help them solve specific problems. So the money will come to the university. There will be a contract between me and the company and the university. The university will control the money, and the work will get done. This way, I could pay for graduate student training. I could also have technicians doing specific work and postdoctoral fellows, etc., etc. You have to be imaginative. If you're just going through granting agencies, it's not easy to get the money because somebody out there is going to tell you this thing will not work. He has never done it, but he's sure it will not work. And you have to be humble enough to say, yeah, he may be right. None of us has done it. So he may be right, I may be wrong. But maybe I'm right and he's wrong, but we have no way of knowing. But you need to open yourself. If you're doing good enough work publishing, you're likely to be approached by pharmaceutical industries. I don't know what happens now, but more than half the money that I had running my labs came from industry. The money will be kept by the university, to keep me honest, to make sure that you are doing the work. And we will publish it. That is a proof that the work was done. I will not undertake any work that could not be published because of patents and so on and so on, which is all right. But when the company approaches you to do something for you, it's their idea to do something for them. So I don't want into this patent business. Let them deal with it. Give me the money, we'll get the job done, and we'll publish it. And that's how it works.
It's so amazing and so wonderful listen to you speak about all these little things, as you call them. Although in my books they're a lot bigger than you can imagine, and how you've done these things over the years. What an honor it is to be speaking with you today, Fred. I would like to ask you now, what is your favorite quotation? Which one do you live by?
I have many, but I will just give you one. It was written in the 1470s by a monk whose job it was to keep young monks focused. A person becomes a monk because he wants to devote his life to God. And it may be difficult to stay focused, so his job was to keep them focused. And he had a quotation that I really admire. He said, "Remember, you'll be dead a lot longer than you lived." Think about it. Those days, people lived maybe 60 years, 70 years, and they believe they went to another world to live there forever. So his advice to them, remember, you'll be dead a lot longer than you lived. So get on with your life and do whatever it is that you came here to do. You don't have a whole lot of time. Stay focused, remembering that you're going to be living somewhere a lot longer than you lived here on earth. And it's something that I take very, very seriously. What that means to me, being somewhat of a Christian, is that God wants us to do what? According to Christ, love our neighbor as ourselves. If you don't do that, you are not living well. And there may be a price to pay on the other side. We get there. So, since you're going to be living there a lot longer than we live here.
What a quotation. What an amazing quotation to live by. That sort of jerked me to reality as soon as you finished saying it, that you
That
would be
would
dead a lot longer
longer than we lived.
than you lived. Wow. What a quotation. I mean, I'm almost stuck for words.
It's not my quotation. This was said by a fellow called Thomas A Kempis. He wrote for me one of the most important books I have ever read. It is called The Imitation of Christ. Now, we need to live our lives the way Christ directed us to live our lives. And among other things, if every person that you see, you should see Christ in them. And I always ask myself, if I saw Christ tomorrow, since he's coming back, would I recognize him? That is a serious question for me. And I found the answer is to treat everybody you meet as a son or daughter of God. That way you will not miss Christ. He will recognize you. You might not recognize him, but at least you're doing what it is that he expects of you to do. Simple. Love your neighbor as yourself.
Yourself. Amazing.
And, treat them the way you want them to treat you as a child or daughter of God.
Thank you so much for sharing.
We're going to move away now just a bit from work. How do you relax, Fred?
Well, my relaxation steps were very, very easy. I used to play tennis when I was younger, and when my knees no longer were very in good shape to play tennis, I walked. And I also loved music, especially a German composer called Ludwig van Beethoven. So every piece of music that he wrote, I have at least a copy of that on a tape, DVD or whatever. But these days, you don't even have to tape these things. You can just go get a Spotify And all this music is there. So that is my relaxation, listening to music that I love. Because that fellow was amazing in terms of his compositions, which were generally written for a reason, depending on the time, that time in his life. He lived a very tough life because by the age of 30, he was totally deaf. And for a musician, that is quite something. But at least he knew how the music sounded in his ears. He was the first full-time composer. But people enjoyed it. Depending on the mood he was in, if he was in a sad mood, the music was appropriate. If he was happy, etc. So this person allows you to dig deep into yourself to find all kinds of interesting release. Music is my therapy. I mean, Ludwig van Beethoven's music is my therapy.
And in terms of favorite food, do you have something that you really enjoy eating?
Yes, my favorite food is peanut butter stew. Yes, that's one of my favorites too. With chicken or fish.
I love peanut butter stew. I love it with chicken though. I should try it with fish. Maybe I eat too much chicken. That's wonderful. Thanks,
Well,
Fred.
I grew up in Ghana where
Yes.
fish was plentiful
Right.
year round, and it was the least expensive type of protein. So I certainly love fish, and peanut butter was always available. In fact, we grew it ourselves. We grew peanuts ourselves. So to make the butter was fairly straightforward. Roast and then grind.
Yes, and simple things. I see the theme of simple coming along again. That's wonderful. Thanks, Fred. So now that you're an emeritus, what do you spend your time doing?
And that might surprise you, and it might not surprise you. The first 6 years or so, I continued to serve on editorial boards of scientific medical journals to review and then approve or disapprove things. I was on the editorial board, so made decisions about what got published and what didn't get published. That sort of kept me interested in the field. And obviously, these days, you don't have to go to any library to read anything in your field that you want to read. You just sit at home and go online to get information from the library, McMaster Library. So this is how I spend a fair bit of my time. I also mentor young Black people. This is something that I did in the 90s a great deal. There was an organization in Hamilton called Diverse Community Achievement. And some friends of ours from McMaster had McMaster undergraduate tutor Black kids in math, English, and sciences to help them get along. And we were fortunate in that there was a company called AIC that was run by a Jamaican fellow, Michael Lee Chin. Lee Chin paid the tutors. No, actually, no, the tutors were paid from monies that we raised elsewhere. But the people that were teaching these students who needed help were retired Black teachers that Michael Lee Chin paid for about 10 years. So we had access to that kind of money. And you get to a point where you have to give some of these things up and let the next generation take up. So I really don't know how that thing, has done. Also, about 25 years ago or so, I was among a group of about six people who started something called Black History Committee that awarded, identified Black achievers in our area to honor them during Black History Month. I was one of the founders of this organization. And when I became emeritus professor with Professor Julia Daniel and Bonnie Ibuwak and Gary Warner, we thought we should start an African Caribbean Faculty Association. We met once a month or so to plan what it is that we wanted to have done. And we will meet at the faculty club over lunch and plan these sort of things. Eventually, some of the areas that we identified as being useful from the university's perspective is to increase the number of Black faculty on campus and also increase the number of Black students on campus. at all levels.
That is very important work you continued to do after you left full-time employment. If you were to give your 21-year-old self advice, what would it be?
I would learn how to do simple things because you know whether or not it worked. I don't think I will live a long life, maybe 90 years like my parents did and grandparents, etc. But there will still be a lot of things to do. So need to have the young people behind you who can carry forward some of the things that you thought were important. They will also discover things that they want to do that will make a difference. If we train one person, you influence one young person to make something better of their life, that is enough because they too would do one person, etc. See, you may have a whole lot of people that are working with you, etc., etc., but they have their own vision, their own agenda. And it's not my job to teach anybody what his agenda is. It's up to them to figure it out and do it. That way they will be motivated. So if only one person out of the many young people that he interacted with did something useful, I'll be happy for that individual who did something useful and the teacher. I am not meant to do great things. Little things that makes a difference in somebody's life. And so they may not even recognize that you had anything to do with it. That's fine. But you did something useful in your view, and perhaps in that person's view, something useful.
We would like to thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and your generosity of sharing all these important reflections and lessons that you have learned throughout your career and your life. So thank you so much for being on the Black Professors podcast.
Thank you so much for the time you spent with me and the opportunity you gave me to share some of what it is I have learned on this journey.
That is all we had in this episode.
Join us next time.
And be sure to follow us on our various social media platforms. The Black Professors Podcast was established in the summer of 2023 as a space to share the often untold stories by Black professors who take us behind the scenes of their career trajectories. The co-executive producers of the Black Professors Podcast are
Dr. Selina Mudavanu, Communication Studies and Media Arts Department, McMaster University,
and Dr. Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare, African Studies Program, University of Calgary. The production team includes undergraduate and graduate students.
The title of the track used in the podcast is Podcast Hip Hop Intro Short by Corporate Sounds, accessed via Jamendo. Our sincere gratitude to the Pulse Lab at McMaster University for graciously allowing us to use the podcast recording equipment. The Black Professors Podcast is supported by generous funding from McMaster University's Arts Research Board.